Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Bruce Springsteen and President Obama are both here. Isn't that amazing? Bruce Springsteen, President Obama. It's fascinating. One guy was born in the USA. The other is constantly asked to prove he was born in the USA.
Conan O'Brien ribbing President Obama at an event last night in Century City. Well, today the president participates in a Democratic National Committee roundtable in Beverly Hills before heading down the coast to San Diego. The president's schedule has been packed tight with fundraiser lunches and $65,000 a plate galas since he touched down in L.A. yesterday. But last time I checked, he's not running for re-election. So where is that money going? Joining us now in studio, Jessica Levinson. She's professor of law at Loyola Law School and an expert on election law. Welcome.
Thank you for having me for our Down with Democracy segment today.
Well, thanks for showing up for it. And so the president and going through all the traffic, the President Obama traffic. So good for you.
Well, thank you. He left when I left, basically. So yeah. He was overhead. I couldn't actually see the bags of money, but I understand that they were in the plane. So that's great.
Lots of bags of money. So what is he raising money for?
So he's raising money for the party committees. He's raising money for the Democratic National Committee. He's raising money for the Senate committees because the midterms are coming up. It's very important who is in control of the Senate. He's raising money for the congressional committees. So maybe what isn't he raising money for, more to the point? But he can go to a lot of different people and say, you know, please write a check of, if it's for the National Committee, $32,400. And that money can be funneled to a lot of different candidates and for a lot of different purposes. So it's very, very important to the Democratic Party that Obama come to the places where there are money and raise that money, because he is still the face of the Democratic Party, and he can get people to open their wallets like nobody else.
And people are able to open their wallets now more and more ever since the McCutcheon Supreme Court decision from about a month ago. And tell us how that's changed fundraising.
So McCutcheon basically doesn't change the base contribution limits, the direct, like how much I can give to you, even though I really want you to win for Congress or Senate or whatever you'd run for. But what it changes is the aggregate contribution limits, how much one person can give total to candidates and committees. So whereas before, a wealthy donor could say, I'm sorry, I maxed out. I gave my $123,700 a year. Now people can keep going back to those donors and say, oh, there's some more candidates that we want you to give to. There's some more state committees that we want you to give to. So McCutcheon is a lot about which vehicle do we want you to give money through? Is it either to the independent groups, which can raise and spend unlimited sums, for instance, the super PACs that everyone hears so much about, the not-so-super PACs, or is it to the party apparatus and candidates? And what McCutcheon now says is you're essentially free to do both, and the only real restriction in place is that base contribution, $2,600 to federal candidates, $32,400 to national parties, and other limits to state parties.
So last night he was raising money for the party. So presumably there's a limit there. Unless someone has already donated elsewhere, they can still donate then to the party under McCutcheon.
Right. So they're limited in the party and how much they can give per year. But the president and other people will keep coming back to these donors, you know, whenever the year or the election cycle is up and say, oh, well, you know, it'd be great to get your support once again. So McCutcheon is going to allow the very big donors to give spread out that money. And what we were talking about before McCutcheon was really there was like 650 people in the country that were maxing out on their contributions. And now the question is, will those 650 give a lot more, or will it be many more people who will now, instead of giving to the independent groups, decide to, you know, come home to the political party and give money through those vehicles?
So will this in some strange way actually strengthen the political parties?
I think it will absolutely strengthen the parties, because the parties will say, we can control the message. We're the best apparatus through which to organize money to get what you want, which is candidates elected. And so, except for the people who are really focused on specific issues, I think that this will be a way for both parties to say, you should let us control the money. You shouldn't give it to this group, Americans for a Better America or Kids for Rainbows. You know, give it to the DNC. We'll get your candidates elected, and we're the best organized to do that. So some have said that it could actually decrease polarization because the party leaders will have much more power because they'll have much more fundraising power, and they'll be able to get kind of the fringe elements in line. And some have said maybe this will actually help loosen gridlock in D.C. So maybe there is some silver lining to McCutcheon. I'm not, you know, I'm a pessimist, so we'll see.
So you see it as just more money concentrated in the hands of the few, or more political power, I should say, concentrated in the hands of the very, very rich.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the problem with campaign finance in general is that after Watergate, basically Congress came to the court and they made a jacket. And then the Supreme Court said, well, we're going to cut off the sleeves of the jacket and we're going to put graffiti on the jacket over years of decisions. And then the Supreme Court said, well, the jacket looks horrible and it doesn't keep you warm anymore. And so that's where we are with respect to campaign finance right now. And I have to say, I think when the next president comes to fundraise in L.A., which he or she undoubtedly will, we may not have those base contribution limits in place anymore.
Really? And so then they'll just be here all the time raising money. We're going to have traffic jams from here to eternity.
Well, so maybe if you can go to one person and raise a lot of money, maybe, and I don't think this will happen, you have to spend less time fundraising, because they can just come to me, you know, raise their $60 million and go home. So they don't have to then go to La Jolla and then go to San Jose and then go to San Francisco and go to lots of different people to raise the same amount. They'll just come to me, they'll get the 60, and they'll go home and do, you know, that thing we actually ask them to do, which is govern and legislate.
Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, expert on election law. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as President Obama helps fill the war chest for the upcoming national elections, there are some pretty hot races brewing right here in Southern California. And you probably received your voter guide for state races this week. Here to make some sense of the statewide primary election coming up on June 3rd is Rafe Sonnenschein. He's the executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Hey, Rafe.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Well, nice to have you. So let's talk about the most high-profile race in California, and that is the race for Henry Waxman's seat in Congress, the 33rd District. And there are some 17 candidates, wow, in the running. And how are we, the poor voter, to winnow them down?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm a voter in that district, and you're going to be getting tons of mail like I am. With all kinds of claims. My guess is we'll be looking at everything from endorsements to whether we recognize the names of the people. And then it'll be winnowed down partly by those who can afford to really campaign.
Yeah, and so this will be a particularly expensive race?
Oh, it's a very expensive race. And some of this is because of term limits in California. A congressional seat is potentially a lifetime seat, and there are very few of those left anymore in California politics. And when one opens up, especially in an active district like this one, people are going to come out everywhere to try to get that seat. These openings don't happen very often.
Well, what's also interesting is there are very few candidates on this list I'm looking at now that have any kind of experience in government.
It's really striking because this is not a particularly anti-government district. It's not only a Democratic district, but a very high voter turnout, highly attentive district. Tends not to attract and reward outsiders all that much. And yet there's only two elected officials of stature in the race, Wendy Gruhl and Ted Lieu. Matt Miller, to some people, practically is an elected official because they've heard him on public radio talking about politics. They know he worked in D.C. And beyond that, you've got a lot of kind of unconventional candidates. I'm not sure this is the best district to be an unconventional candidate. I'm a little surprised that there aren't more of the conventional candidates in the race.
So who rises to the top? Who is most likely to get the most votes, do you think, at this point?
Well, you know, as entertaining as many of the candidates are, at the end of the day, it helps to have been on a ballot before. And I think that Wendy Gruhl and Ted Lieu, Wendy Gruhl, the former city controller and mayoral candidate, and Ted Lieu, a state senator, are very well known, have a lot of people who have voted for them before, which is a huge advantage. The real thing is, can one of those two elected officials not get to the number two spot and have somebody else sneak in to that number two spot for the runoff, which will be required no matter whether anybody gets a majority or not? I still think the two elected officials should be considered the favorites.
Okay, and there will definitely be a runoff because this is an open primary.
It's one of the quirks of California's top two primary system that I truly don't understand, this particular quirk. If you got 85% of the vote in the first round, you would still have to run again in November against somebody who perhaps got 8% of the vote. I think that's a little nutty. On the other hand, it's been enormously entertaining for observers to try to game out these top two primaries, and all kinds of wild stuff can happen with that second spot.
Okay, let's go down the ballot a little bit and talk about some county races. And this, there's a lot of action. Two Board of Supervisor seats open.
Well, this is the year of the county, and that's partly because it's a midterm non-presidential year, and the county holds its elections in even-numbered years, so suddenly all this stuff is happening at the county. Plus, we actually paid attention to the county because of the jail crisis and the stuff with Sheriff Baca. Suddenly people are noticing. There's two seats, one on the east side, Gloria Molina's seat in the 1st District, which clearly is going to be filled by Hilda Solis, a former member of the Obama cabinet, does not have strong opposition. In this case, if you get a majority, you're done. But the more competitive race to replace Zev Yaroslavsky in the 3rd District, which includes the West Side and almost all of the San Fernando Valley, this is another high-profile district, has drawn some very strong candidates. The two leading ones are Bobby Shriver, former mayor of Santa Monica, and Sheila Kuehl, former state legislator and community activist, two very strong candidates, and also John Duran from West Hollywood, mayor of West Hollywood. So actually, this could go in a lot of different directions. And if nobody gets a majority, this could go on to the fall and be a very exciting race.
And Gloria Molina has endorsed Hilda Solis. And what about Zev Yaroslavsky? Is he endorsing anyone?
I don't know that he's spoken on that race. It's not a district where his profile is very high. I think his district, the race in the 3rd District where he has not made an endorsement is where his endorsement could make a very big difference. And I'm not at all convinced that he will make an endorsement. I don't think he would do anything until the runoff anyway.
And what are the big issues then for this race, and what are they running on?
Well, it's not entirely clear yet. And one of the things about these primaries is it's very risky to take too strong a position on anything when you're running in the primary, because you would like to get the endorsement of the candidates who don't make it into the runoff. So you don't want to get anybody too angry.
All right. Also, a big story is who's going to be the next sheriff of L.A. County. And, of course, Lee Baca forced to drop out of the race after the feds announced investigations and indictments regarding the jails. And that is a very competitive race as well.
And it's beyond that, Madeline. We're actually introducing democracy to the sheriff's department, which comes as a tremendous shock to anybody who knows the history of the sheriff's department. Usually it was more like a monarchy. And it would be sent, except not by family blood, but normally the sheriff would serve for about 25 years. This goes back about 80, 90 years. And they'd hand it off to a favored person who would then serve for another 20, 25 years and hand it off. So you almost never had a competitive race. Nobody has any clue what's supposed to happen in a sheriff's race. Well, now, with all the problems in the jails, we've got an actual race on our hands. And we've got insider candidates and outsider candidates and endorsements and people having to go to debates and actually debate issues. It's really quite shocking. I think it's very healthy. My only worry is I haven't seen much discussion in this contest about who would keep the sheriff accountable, since the sheriff is elected and not really controlled by the Board of Supervisors. Everybody thinks it's the chief of police. But in L.A. City, you've got the council, the mayor, and the police commission to watch that chief. I would like to know a little bit. I'd like someone to ask, if you don't deliver on what you're saying about cleaning up the jails, what are we going to be able to do about it? Haven't heard that one yet.
Well, I guess they would say the voters are the ones.
Well, yeah, that's what Sheriff Baca used to say, too. That didn't work out too well. I don't know if everybody realizes there are no term limits in the sheriff's office. So we could be in for another 25 years. And low-profile sheriff's races aren't going to be a very good vehicle for accountability. This is our only chance.
Ray Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Thanks, Rafe.
My pleasure.
And KCRW will continue to take a close look at the ballot and the candidates leading up to the June 3rd primary. Next week, KCRW's Warren Olney will be moderating a debate between four of the candidates for Zev Yaroslavsky's seat on the LA Board of Supervisors. That's next Tuesday evening at 7 on Which Way LA. Coming up, it sliced and diced its way into our pop culture, the infomercial, how big business is changing the kitschy 30-minute commercials that used to be all over late-night TV. That story is next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's talk about the lowly infomercial.
Hi, it's Vince with ShamWow. You'll be saying wow every time you use this towel. It's like a chamois, it's like a towel, it's like a sponge. A regular towel doesn't work wet. This works wet or dry. This is for the house, the car, the boat, the RV. ShamWow holds 20 times its weight in liquid. Look at this. It just does the work.
Since the 1950s, late-night TV has been the world of the infomercial. Hucksters selling Ginsu knives, wearable towels, Snuggies. But infomercials have become a victim of their own success. At more than $200 billion, the late-night direct response television industry has attracted big companies that are squeezing out the backyard inventors that used to populate the space. So is the infomercial as we know it disappearing? And is that really a bad thing? Here to tell us more is Ariel Bogle. She's a researcher with Future Tense, and that's a channel on Slate.com. She's recently written a story about infomercials. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're really not going to see commercials like the ShamWow ones too much anymore?
Well, I don't think they're going away entirely. It just won't be the small inventor in his backyard in Tennessee or in Salt Lake City making all the money off that ShamWow anymore. These days, a product like that is more likely to come out of big direct response television marketing companies, something like Telebrands or Guthy Renker or a whole host of others.
Well, tell us how it works. Let's say you do have a product like the ShamWow and you want to sell it on TV. What do you do?
Well, it used to be in the old days, maybe in the 80s and early 90s, you could get together a bit of money and put together an infomercial, and probably about one in three infomercial products had a great chance of success. But these days, if you want to make any money, you really need to go to one of these big companies, and through them, they take on perhaps hundreds of products a year, market test them, put together an ad, but probably only 5 out of 100 these days is a hit on the scale of the Snuggie or the ShamWow.
So they get most of the money, these companies, not the inventor?
That's right. People I talked to in the industry thought that the average amount of royalties a small-time inventor might get is about 3%. And I've heard up to 7%, but, you know, it's not that much.
And when did this all start changing?
Well, really, probably in the early 90s, it started changing, particularly because the infomercial as a format started to appeal to bigger brands, brands like Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble. They saw value in that format because it's kind of a cheap time of the day in that sort of midday segment or in the early hours of the morning to advertise. So you can really market test your product. So they started to take over the segment, which kind of pushed up the expenses of that time segment.
So the more companies were interested, the more expensive the airtime got?
Yeah, and that really pushes out the little guy who can't afford to raise millions just to advertise his bacon bowl, for example, or his Snapchat. So the only way to get together the money to advertise in that segment is now to sort of pitch your product to one of these big marketing companies.
Did you just say bacon bowl?
I did just say bacon bowl. In fact, that's one of the biggest hits these days in the infomercial market.
Introducing Bacon Bowl, the easy way to make delicious edible bowls out of bacon for fun, savory, crunchable yum. Just wrap your favorite cut of bacon around the Bacon Bowl form and cook. In just minutes, you'll have tasty, toasty bacon bowls.
Okay, so for those of us who haven't seen that, and I think people are now going on YouTube right now to check it out, but if you haven't seen it, describe what the Bacon Bowl is.
Well, the Bacon Bowl is not, in fact, a bacon bowl. You don't get sent bacon in the mail, which is probably a good thing. It's really a sort of mold that a guy called Tom Jensen in Salt Lake City invented, and you sort of wrap the bacon around it, and then you can create your own bacon bowl, as many as you like, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but
so what's his story, though, with regards to trying to sell it on late-night television?
Well, I spoke with Tom, and he is an inventor. He works, he has a day job, but in the evenings, on the weekends, he told me he's always tinkering in his garage, coming up with all different types of inventions. But what he's doing, he's not trying to sell these products himself. In fact, he's going to online places like Edison Nation, which is an online platform which allows inventors to submit products in response to company calls for products. So the Bacon Bowl actually was, he submitted as part of a competition for As Seen on TV products. So he entered it on Edison Nation online. It went through all different kinds of procedures that Edison Nation tests the products, make sure there's nothing too similar out there, and steps like that. At the end, they accepted his product, collaborated with Allstar, which is a big direct response television company, and the rest is history. I think that it's shifted, he told me, about 2 million units since late 2013.
But he only gets a small fraction of that, right?
Right. He told me he's getting about 7% royalties, which is actually some of the better level than some I've heard about in the industry.
And is that where infomercials are going, to the internet?
So these days, because of time shifting and the sort of move online with television content, there are really less eyes on infomercials. So the strategy that it seems infomercial marketers and big brands like Johnson & Johnson are taking is they're putting infomercials on TV to market test and really push consumers towards retail stores like Walmart or Target, or to their online shops, online outlets.
And what about the viewing experience? Because infomercials on TV are really long. They're 30 minutes or so, and you kind of settle in like you're watching
right,
one of your stories or something. And but online, there's not a lot of patience to watch something for longer than, say, 3 minutes.
Right. And I think that's something that the industry is really struggling with. It seemed when I was talking to people in the industry that they're really in a time of flux. There's still a lot of money being made, but it's really unclear how the internet's going to affect them in the long term. Because, as you said, no one wants to watch a 30-minute infomercial online unless it's kind of a funny one on YouTube.
Right. So is that kind of sad to you?
Well, you know, reading through the comments on my article, it seemed that a lot of people were definitely not sad about the demise of the infomercial. But personally, I'm kind of nostalgic for it. It's kind of a fun, kitschy element of advertising and American industry. And I'm kind of sad to see it go.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the infomercial and what was the first infomercial? How did it get started, this business?
Sure. Well, people have, of course, been advertising on television for a long time, ever since the format was invented. But people generally agree that the first official infomercial was in 1949, when William Bernard, the founder of the Vitamix company, advertised his very special blender on television.
Mm-hmm.
So that's generally agreed to be the first infomercial with that format we're all familiar with. The guy identifies a problem in your life. It's really hard to get healthy food blended quickly and easily. Then he demonstrates how it works, then offers you a deal you can't refuse, as the saying goes. From then, the golden age really began in the 1980s. In 1984, President Reagan sort of deregulated a lot of the television industry, and suddenly you could have advertisements which were longer in format. That was the time when you could start to have 30-minute advertisements. He also put together some laws that really deregulated the cable industry. Suddenly there were thousands of channels that all needed content, and it was really a sort of feeding frenzy for the infomercial.
Right. And then there's, in terms of content, in terms of style, there's definitely a formula when it comes to the infomercial. As you mentioned, there is a...
That's right.
There's a script. And what I find really funny is, like, all the stuff that's happening that's bad that the thing can fix is filmed in black and white. And then magically, right, once you buy the product, your world becomes in Technicolor.
That's right. And it always looks like it's your world, too. You know, it's never too flashy. It looks like it could be your backyard, your kitchen,
yeah,
that they're testing the product in.
And they always have real people giving their testimonials.
Right, but the influence of the sort of B, C-list celebrity shouldn't be underestimated either.
The Suzanne Summers of the world?
Exactly. And although George Foreman, I think, had very little, if not nothing, to do with the George Foreman grill, his face is really recognizable as part of that infomercial sort of world, too.
Yeah, and definitely, and that brings up this idea of the infomercial product crossing over into, I guess, mainstream retail. I mean, the
right.
George Foreman grill is everywhere. So is the Thighmaster, or it was.
Right, yeah. That's another thing I think that people don't realize about the infomercial industry. It's really given us a lot of our household brands that we no longer associate them with their sort of kitschy origins. But in fact, you know, things like Proactive, OxiClean, and the George Foreman grill, as you mentioned, all had their birth really in the infomercial.
And the Bacon Bowl guy,
mm-hmm,
how's he doing? And is he happy with his invention and how it was sold? Maybe he can quit his day job.
Yeah, maybe. But I think he seemed like... This is another nice thing that I've found that I think about the infomercial is that it sort of gives these backyard inventors a sort of outlet that it wouldn't be accessible to them otherwise. So he's an inventor, you know. He said he had 20 to 30 products in his back pocket that he was hoping to at some point submit to Edison Nation. And so maybe he'll have another hit in a year or two.
Wow. One can only imagine. One can only hope.
One can only hope.
Ariel Bogle is a researcher with Future Tense, a channel on Slate.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, maybe you can get your mom a bacon bowl for Mother's Day. Hint, hint, hint. Or you can watch a movie with her. When we come back, we're going to look at a few movies where mom is the main character. It's all in celebration of Mother's Day after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Mother's Day is right around the corner, so what are you planning to do with mom on Sunday? After brunch is over, that is. Well, how about sitting down to watch a film that makes you appreciate her even more? We have some suggestions for you from our friend Mark Jordan Legan, TV writer and film historian. Welcome back.
It's good to be here. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. So I hope you're celebrating your mother.
I am. And, you know, first of all, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And secondly, you know, look, there are plenty middle-of-the-road commercial mom films that are sweet and sappy, but today we pulled together a few that are fun, offbeat, and strange, which may just describe many of our listeners' relationships with their mom.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, first up, we have the very witty Albert Brooks film from 1996, Mother. It stars Brooks and the legendary film star Debbie Reynolds. Brooks plays a recently divorced author suffering from such intense writer's block and midlife crisis, he is ready to try anything, including moving back in with his mother, hoping that staying in his boyhood room will jar his emotions and writing back to life. But his mother isn't quite sure about this.
Honey, tell me again, because people will start asking, you're here, why?
Why? Well, it's complicated, Mother, but you know why.
Well, you're having problems and you're blaming me. Is that it?
I'm not blaming anyone. It's just that things aren't working out so great with the women in my life right now, and I feel that until I can figured this situation out, I probably will never be able to figure that situation out. So, you know, whatever I learn here, I'll take into that part of my life and apply it there. Hey, that's a very good way to say it.
Hmm? Oh, I wasn't listening. Tell them what?
This is one of the problems.
That seems very real, doesn't it?
Yes.
That's just it. This movie really captures how adult children and their moms can sometimes never quite communicate, and also how a parent can be critical and not even realize it.
I knew you look good.
But.
What, dear?
Just wondering when the butt's coming.
Is that what you think I do?
Well, I don't think you do it. That's what you do.
Anything by it. It's just something a mother does.
Well, I don't know that every mother does that. I don't think every mother says, honey, you look good, but your hair is thinning.
Oh, honey, I never told you your hair was thinning.
Yes, you did. The last time I was at the house, on my way out, you called after me. Look out for your bald spot, remember?
Oh, well, someone has to say that.
She's so perfect.
She's perfect.
But you know what? I heard that she wasn't the first actress to be offered that role.
That's true.
That he really wanted Nancy Reagan for that role.
Yes, he did. He offered it to Nancy Reagan, and apparently she read it and liked it very much, but she ended up not doing it. You know, probably because her astrologer told her not to.
Right.
Boom! 90s topical comedy.
Well, her loss, because that is a really funny role.
It is.
All right, what's next?
Well, next up is a nice 1-2 punch from the 70s. First, from 1974, we have sexy Angie Dickinson in Big Bad Mama, where she plays a dirt poor mother with two teenage daughters. And in this clip, we can hear how good she is with them.
Try to teach you girls manners and look at you. Sitting there with your underpants showing, holding the damn doll. Dumb enough to want to marry Charlie Johnson.
I'm going
to
marry rich man, Mama, and then hope he dies and I get his money.
You keep your legs together, Billie Jean, and shut up. I'll tell you when to get married.
Now, that's good advice.
That is good motherly advice.
It's tough love.
Maybe delivered in a salty way, but.
Yeah. Now, this film is also famous for the nude scene Angie Dickinson has with none other than Captain Kirk, William Shatner.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Woo-hoo. Set your phasers to fun. That film. Wow. Anyway, that's film. And listen, another nice companion piece to Big Bad Mama is Bloody Mama. Also from the Roger Corman 70s factory. Only this time, Shelley Winters vividly portrays the legendary Depression-era bank robber, Ma Barker.
If it wasn't for the fact that they got your blood in their veins, I would have killed you a long time ago. I would have killed you. Oh, Papa. Papa.
This is Ma Barker.
Papa!
And her boys. They do a lot of different things. They love people, all kinds of people. And they have a mother who understands.
All right, now everybody reach for the knife down to the Lord. Reach!
This is Bloody Mama, the incredible saga of Ma Barker and her boys, the most bloodthirsty killers in the history of crime.
Oh, my gosh. I love that 70s voiceover, too.
There's nothing like it. You know, this 1970 film is actually a lot of fun. And also, one of her sons is played by none other than Robert De Niro in one of his very first speaking roles.
Really?
Yeah. And actually, Bruce Dern's in it and Tom Skerritt. It's a really interesting film.
Okay. What's next?
Well, let's move from armed robbery to emotional robbery. This next Mother's Day movie is a treat. It has a rabid cult following, but is rather unknown. Now, in the late 60s, Betty Davis reinvented herself with classic creepy films like Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Well, in 1968, she starred in this film adaptation of a very successful British stage play called The Anniversary. And every year, even though the father is long dead, she insists her grown sons and their wives, girlfriends, grandkids show up every year to honor the wedding anniversary. And Betty Davis chews up the scenery and everyone else in it. Now, here they discuss what she got the grandkids for presents.
They're waiting for you, Mum.
They're waiting to see what I bought them.
Well, what have you bought them then, Mum?
You see, Shirley, no subtleties with Karen. What have you bought them? If you want to know, I'm giving them money.
Oh, good idea. Then they can buy what they like.
I've already bought it. I'm putting the money in trust funds so no one can get their hands on it. They're impatient, I know. I've had 3 chicks of my own. Only 3, I grant you, Karen. But natural good manners told me when to put the plug in.
Wow.
Love you, Mom.
Nothing like Bette Davis to really capture that fragile.
I should also add that Bette Davis's character wears an eye patch through the entire movie, and the eye patch changes colors to match her many outfits.
Any explanation for the eye patch?
I think it looks fabulous. Let me put it that way.
It gives
way.
Her that extra air of je ne sais
quoi. One more quick clip. Here she finds out one of her timid sons wants to move away to Canada.
Always been the same, Terry. Whenever you were a naughty boy, straight into a shell you'd go. Terry was never a leader, Shirley. He was always led. And now he's being led off to Canada by that pregnant cow over there.
Yeah. She's really got a thing about pregnancy in this movie.
Yeah, you know, so it's kind of like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but with a one-eyed Bette Davis.
She's what more could you ask for?
She's amazing in this movie. She really is. But I tell you what, we'll close with one great legitimate tearjerker, the excellent Oscar-winning Terms of Endearment from 1983.
That is the ultimate tearjerker.
It is. And, you know, it's one of the most touching, realistic examples of a mother-daughter relationship. And in the film, it covers over 30 years. Shirley MacLaine won a Best Actress Oscar for playing the straight-shooting control freak Aurora Greenway. And here, the night before the wedding, she tells her daughter, brilliantly played by Deborah Winger, that she is making a huge mistake.
I'm totally convinced. If you marry Flap Horton tomorrow, it will be a mistake of such gigantic proportions, it will ruin your life and make wretched your destiny.
Why are you doing this to me?
You are not special enough to overcome a bad marriage. Emma, use your brains. Flap is limited. He hasn't got any imagination. Even at this age, all he wants is a secure teaching job.
Mother, I'm marrying Flap Horton tomorrow. I thank God for Flap for getting me out of here. And I think if this is your attitude, you shouldn't bother showing up at my wedding.
Mm-hmm. It's one of their many battles in this film. And in this next dinner time scene, the now married Deborah Winger wants to share some big news with Mom.
What's wrong with you?
I got some good news.
What's that?
I'm unofficially pregnant. I mean, we haven't gotten the test back yet, but you know me, I'm never late.
Well, now I don't understand.
If you're not happy for me, I'm gonna get so mad if you're not happy.
Why should I? Why should I be happy about being a grandmother?
Does this mean you won't be knitting the baby any booties?
It's a wonderful film filled with three-dimensional characters, and it perfectly blends humor with drama.
Yeah. Well, there are some similarities between her and the Bette Davis character in terms of their, let's say, mixed feelings about having babies.
Yes, very much so.
Being moms and grandmoms. I'm trying to figure out what you're trying to say about mothers here. Do you have some unresolved issues with your own mother?
That's a whole nother segment, Madeline. I'll just say Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Mark Jordan Ligon, film historian, TV writer.
Loving son.
Loving son. Let's get that in. Thanks, Mark. For a full list of the films we just talked about, check out our blog. Go to kcrw.com/pressplay. And while you're there, let us know what your favorite mom movie is. We're in All Knees here now.
Not a mom.
Not a mom.
No. We're going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision about the prayer in public places and what is allowable and what isn't. It's quite a change, and it's going to lead to some very interesting situations around the country. We had a woman on who advises local governments, and she said her worst nightmares are about to occur.
Oh, gosh. All right. We're looking forward to some nightmares at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, can a city outlaw bullying? Well, the city of Carson is about to do that. We'll find out just how this new law can be enforced next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps, available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Bullying is a problem usually left for parents, for teachers, and for schoolyard justice to resolve. Well, now the city of Carson wants to get involved in it. The city council there voted unanimously this week to make bullying a criminal offense. The measure won't be finalized until later this month, but if it goes forward, bullying in Carson would be punished as a misdemeanor. And that could mean court hearings, fines, perhaps even jail time. So how does a city enforce a no-bullying law? Mike Gibson is a Carson city councilman who co-authored the proposed anti-bullying measure, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Natalie?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, how would you define bullying under this ordinance?
Well, we define bullying as when one individual take advantage by physical, because bullying comes in different forms, verbal, physical, mental, and the list goes on and on. There's about 12 identified key phrases that quantify what bullying is. And so in this case, bullying is where one person intentionally take advantage of another person through tormenting and through physical abuse. And as you know, cyberbullying has taken off unparalleled heights, where people are now being bullied through emails, text messages, through social media, and things of that nature.
Would this only apply to children?
It goes all the way up to an adult, as a matter of fact. So it's 5, 25, and older. And
5 to age 25?
Yes, because what we found out through our discussion on this Tuesday night before we passed the ordinance is that parents can also use their children to encourage them to be bullies. Go, for example, go, because I had an argument with someone's mother at the PTA. This is an example. Go and, you know, go and beat up her son or her daughter, pull her hair, torment her. We have found that these things exist through our research, and it's been documented that parents also can be responsible for their children being bullied. And also, kids who have been bullied themselves can grow up to be bullies themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've also found through our research, this is something that has happened time and time again. And I also want to make mention that when I was growing up, I don't know how old you are, but when I was growing up, my parents always tell me sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt. Well, Mom and Dad, that's not right. Words do hurt. Words cause and pierce people's very fabric, their heart,
mm-hmm.
that would cause them to slip into depressional states that will want and make them commit suicide. And it's been documented after documentation,
right,
that people go and commit suicide as a result of being bullied.
Well, how would you enforce this, though? And how, you know, it sounds pretty vague, your definition of bullying. It could be, could it be something as seemingly minor as some kid saying to another kid, I don't like your haircut?
No, this is something that has, remember, a bully is something that if they target you, it's something that's going to continue on. It's not something that's going to be as a random fight or something where a bully will set his or her eyes on you as a target and continue to stalk you, continue to do mean and evil things and say mean and evil things.
But who defines what mean and evil is?
Who define? Well, I guess you would define that based on the torment and what the person saying to you and making you feel.
So you would have to make a complaint to the police? Is that
yeah.
how it would work?
Make a complaint to the authorities, whether in school or either outside the school. Make a complaint. You have to show proof. You have to show that this is, in fact, a pattern. And most people in adolescent age, it starts with on the computer through social media and things of that nature, and it spills over into the school and spills over into the community. But the person's waiting for you after school, down the street, at the store, and that is taunting you, that is harassing you, that is pulling your hair, that is throwing rocks at you, that is saying mean and evil things. So that is a a track record and a pattern that you can point to substantiate this person is meets the definitions of a bully.
Okay, and so then if that is deemed as a bullying infraction under this new ordinance,
it
the perpetrator
$100 as a fine, and it goes $200. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So this would be mainly children, you're saying, doing this.
Yes.
And so they would be on the hook for the fine, or the parents? And
the parents would be. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then you have to understand this, right? That if I am a father and my son or daughter is displaying these kinds of attributes, right, then and my son or daughter get a fine as a result of what they're doing, which is an infraction. Now parents have to pay $100. One, it's a wake-up call, but you have to take control of your kid, and or hopefully you will find professional help so your kid can address the anger, the learned behavior that they he or she is in fact experiencing, so they can get help, you know, so they won't have to do this to others.
All right. Mike Gibson, Carson City Councilman, co-authored the city's new proposed anti-bullying measure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And now let's look at a place where this is already the law. Bob Miller, the mayor of Monona, Wisconsin, a town that's had an anti-bullying law on the books for about a year. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, my pleasure. And have you had to exercise the punishment part of this law since it's been in effect?
We passed our ordinance a year ago at the end of this month of May. And subsequent to that, we have had to cite two parents. The unique aspect of our ordinance, which we learned, it was not intended but unintended notoriety, was the parental fines. And that seemed to have created a lot of buzz around the world. And we have fines starting at $114 towards the parents that can rise up to $177. And in the last year, first, they are notified by letter, the parents, of behaviors of their children, and we've had to send that letter twice to two families, and that resolved the issue in both cases. So we have not fined anyone.
Okay. What happened in those cases?
The police are contacted.
I mean, what was the infraction? What?
I don't know the specifics. As mayor, I don't get involved into the day-to-day on that, but in talking to the officer, the police were notified by the victim, and so the victim and the perpetrator were interviewed by the police. There was not an improvement in the behavior, so a letter on the perpetrator, so a letter was sent to the parents notifying them and alerting them to some behavioral issues, and I've been told that in both cases that's all it took.
So you don't have a problem, obviously, with this law. Do you think that there are some issues, though, in terms of it possibly violating the First Amendment?
I'm sure it can, and legal scholars. All I know is the experience. This hit went viral a year ago, and I've done hundreds of these interviews around the world, and the feedback has been at least 95% positive. And that question always comes up, and how do you define bullying? And it's one of those age-old statements. I think a parent or a teacher or a police officer knows it when they see it. And this is a civil ordinance, so that there was talk about you're going to send people to jail. No one's going to jail. It's just a financial penalty, and as has been proven to be the case, just notifying the parents was enough to remedy it. And hopefully a little bit of a more proactive approach versus a reactive approach to school violence or bullying, I think is the right thing to do. So I'm proud we have done this.
And, I mean, some people might think, well, this is not the purview of city government. This is the purview of parents. This is a disciplinary action that should be a family issue or a school issue. So why is it that the government has to get involved in this?
I totally agree. It is a parental issue. And as your last guest, Mr. Gibson, noted, because of cyberbullying, there's so often the parents are not even aware of what their child's doing. You might debate whether that's right or wrong. They don't know, but they don't know. So by notifying them, perhaps that is a benefit for parenting. So it's not that the government is meddling in that. It's just assisting. And the research that was done, a year was spent by the police officer who brought this forth. And it was time and time again, it was found that nearly all the perpetrators of the school shootings that are so abhorrent felt they were victims of bullying. So it was just one step that I feel in the total scheme of things is relatively innocuous. Mm-hmm. And to intervene in a relatively subtle way, but with a way where there's the financial fine if there's not cooperation.
Bob Miller, mayor of Monona, Wisconsin, that's near Madison, Wisconsin, talking about their anti-bullying law. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Hello there, Julie Myers.
Hello,
you're
Madeline.
Here with the mail.
I am, and act now if you want to be in our feedback segment.
I know what you're referring to.
But wait, there's more. We talked about infomercials. That's my best infomercial.
That's pretty good.
Voice. I think that I have a second career that I can go into here. And I'm actually just going to hijack our feedback segment today so I can play some of my favorite infomercials.
Okay.
I want to start with the wearable towel.
Robes are heavy and hot, and towels with fasteners? I think not. Now there's the wearable towel. The towel with arm openings.
Towels are hard. Why can't I figure out how to use
isn't
a towel,
called,
Madeline?
Isn't that called a terry cloth robe?
It is hilarious. It's this like sort of big terry cloth tank top, and the you're doing it wrong moment in the infomercial is so funny. It's somebody trying to put like a towel around themselves, and they just can't figure it out. It's perfect. Another one of my favorites, something called the boyfriend pillow.
Wrap yourself up in the boyfriend body pillow. This boyfriend arm pillow is a soft and cozy body pillow that resembles a torso of a man with a comforting arm that cradles and holds you throughout the night.
It's like the creepiest thing ever. It's like a dismembered quadrant of a male's
that is
body.
So sad.
And it's wearing like this button-up shirt to bed and you're like cozied up into the armpit. It's totally sad and completely hilarious. And
but all of these are making me want to buy more.
Wait. Yeah.
But wait, there's more.
One more.
Oh, no. You missed that putt again. You probably don't have enough time to practice. You can have more time to practice your putting with the Putty Putter, the amazing new toilet time golf game that lets you practice your putting on the putty.
So, do you still want to buy, Madeline?
I take that back.
Okay,
I spoke too
good.
Soon.
Okay, thanks, Madeline.
But that bacon thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. If you want to talk about your favorite infomercial, please leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. And that's it for us. Warren Olney and To the Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.